Any questions about that? Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you say EBP plus 4 and you save that value into EBP, you have just changed EBP, and that's a bad idea.
Okay.
You will not see that happening. The function of EBP will stay the same throughout the function. But if you wanted to reference various values in the stack, you keep EBP the same.
So it's not like an array, then.
If you wanted to reference values within an array, you would still do it with respect to EBP. You might add some values, but you're not going to save the result in EBP. You're going to save the result into some other register because you don't want to change EBP. Yes. So you cannot push and pop things out of the middle of the stack. By definition, when you push something, it's always on top of the stack. When you pop something, it's always from the top of the stack. Yes.
So you see something that's trapped.
Well, so you will not, so push instruction does not support the notion of pushing something that's not the top of the stack. You might see, though, that some variables are updated in the middle of the stack. That's okay, as long as you reference that variable with respect to EBP. So in this case, let's say a function wants to update var1. It can do that. It's going to refer to var1 as EBP minus 8, and it can store some value there. That's okay. But that variable will not be removed from the stack. It'll continue existing on that stack. It's just that its value will be updated. But if you wanted to actually remove it, you would have to do it from the top. So I got an example here. As long as you understand this conceptually, oh yeah, one more thing that kind of complicates things a little bit. Or it might make things easier depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. The way IDA Pro shows things to you is it'll always show you EBP plus. Even if it's referring to a local variable, which should be EBP minus 8 or minus 4, IDA Pro will always show it to you as EBP plus. And then it's going to show you some variable name. So you're going to see a thing like EBP plus var4. But if you right-click on this, you're going to see that var4 is actually a negative value. So it will be EBP minus something, but it's going to be EBP plus negative value. So it's trying to do that so that you don't have to think positive, negative. Just call this variable 4. Just call this argument C. That's how IDA Pro is trying to help you. So you don't really need to maintain that distinction. If you see EBP plus arg C, just call it argument C, or call this variable 4. So let's look at some examples. This is what a typical function would look like. It's a pretty simple function. What I want you to focus on is on the way it begins and the way it ends, because that is very common. In the very beginning of the function, you see push EBP. We're saving the value of EBP onto the stack. Why are we doing that? Because a function cannot just assume that a register is not needed. You see, a second instruction places a value into EBP. Before a function overrides some register, it needs to save it onto the stack in case that register's value is needed by some other block of code. So, ultimately, what we want to do is we want to save ESP into EBP. Why? Because ESP will keep on changing, but what we're doing is we're saving the current top of the stack into EBP. But before we can overwrite EBP, we need to save its current value onto the stack. When the function completes its execution at the very end, in the epilogue, we see the opposite. The very last thing that we do is we pop EBP from the stack. We pushed it when we began the function's execution, we pop it right before we exit. The epilogue undoes the prologue. So before we exit, we restore EBP to its previous value. And also, we restore ESP to the way it was, because the function is supposed to leave the state of the world just like it found it. So one of the last things that we do is we restore ESP. It used to be stored in EBP. We place it back into ESP. So whatever the top of the stack was, if for whatever reason ESP was changed here, the function is going to clean up the stack by restoring ESP to the way it was. We also here see references to three parameters. How do I know these are parameters? Because it's EBP plus some value. EBP plus some value are parameters or arguments that were passed to the function. So we see EBP plus 8, 0C, and 10C. These are three different values, three different parameters that were passed to the stack. Yes. In this case, I'm using IDA Pro, and you're wondering why is it using square brackets, let's say. Is that what you're wondering?
No.
A good question. Didn't I just say that IDA Pro would show me everything as positive, right?
Yes.
So there is a way to tell IDA Pro not to try to outsmart you. And so what I'm doing here is actually showing you the absolute values that IDA Pro is not trying to conceal from me. So if you see the actual numbers here, you can interpret them as numbers. These are positive numbers. Positive numbers means I'm referring to parameters. If instead of these numbers, you saw names like X, Y, Z, then you would need to check, those names representative of negative or positive values? So you're wondering, so we also had a push ECX onto the stack. Where do we undo that? Where do we undo this push of ECX? Very good point. The reason, so push ECX, put a value onto the stack and modified ESP. Well, regardless of where ESP is, we're restoring it before we exit. So this move EBP into ESP puts ESP to the way it was before this push. So in the stack, you just clear the stack, yeah. Get rid of all the local variables that I may have defined. Yes. So you're asking about the add operation. It's literally adding things. So let's go through that. So look, let's see what's going on here. Push EBP. We're saving EBP to the stack because we're about to override it, and we save ESP into EBP. This is a common function prolog. Then we push ECX to the stack. Why ECX? What's in ECX that's so important? Actually, nothing is important in ECX. This is just one of the ways in which you can allocate some space on the stack for a single value. Then we have the move operation. We look at this parameter called 8. It's EBP plus 8. It's some parameter that was passed into the function, and we place its value into EAX. The next instruction takes another parameter, 0C, and it adds that value to what's currently in EAX. So now we've added these two values. The third instruction here takes a third parameter and it adds it to what's currently in EAX. So these are literal add operations. Then, what do? We take EAX and we move it into a local variable. Why do we know it's a local variable? Because it's EBP minus some value. This is the variable for which we allocated the space using push ECX. Then what do? Well, we take that local variable and we save it back into EAX. Remember that most functions are supposed to return their values in the EAX register. You might wonder, what's up with this? We're saving EAX into a local variable, and then we're grabbing the data and we're putting it back into EAX. Seems unnecessary, right? I agree. This code is not optimized. The compiler did a poor job. There is a way in which we can make this more efficient. But to show you this example, we told the compiler, don't try to be smart, just show us the code as is. So we told it not to do any optimization, so that's why you see things that are a little bit silly. But it's fully functional code still. Once we've done our computations and we save the return value into EAX, we execute the epilogue of the function, we restore the ESP register. This effectively gets rid of all the local variables that we have defined. And then we restore EBP, and then we return from this function. This is how the prologue and the epilogue look like. You see, EBP is defined, and with respect to EBP, it refers to local variables and to parameters. Any questions about this, the prologue and the epilogue, and the use of EBP? What does this function do? It adds three values. This is actually the function that we compiled here. This is the function. It accepts three parameters, it defines a local variable, it adds those three parameters, stores the result into this variable, and then returns it. That's what that function does. This is how it looks in assembly. All right. Well, now is our scheduled break time. So how about we break for lunch? We're going to resume in an hour and 15 minutes at 1:30. Well, let's get going. We talked about functions and specifically the way functions use the stack to keep track of parameters and local variables. And it's a very important concept to understand. And so as you go through the materials today and maybe if you review this tonight, if this is still not clear to you, please let me know because I want to make sure you understand this. I want to make sure you understand how the EBP register in you is used and why to refer to local variables and parameters. One more thing I wanted to tell you about this slide before I move on to the next set of slides is that the last two instructions in the epilogue are so frequently seen that there's a single instruction to do move EBP to ESP and pop EBP. There's a single instruction that Intel implemented. It's called leave. So sometimes you're going to see these two move and pop instructions used explicitly, or sometimes you're going to see a single instruction called leave. It's the same thing. Leave is another way of implementing these two instructions, but in a single step. Something else that's worth talking about is the way the function is called. How does the function know where to return to when it's done? At the end of the function, there is this little return instruction. How does it know where to go at the end of the code execution? Well, if you look at the state of the stack when the function is called, when the function is called, that call statement is actually just a jump. It's not all that different from an unconditional jump, with the only exception that before it jumps into the function's code, it stores the return value onto the stack. So a call, if a call as a single command did not exist, would still be okay. All we would need to do is we would need to manually save the state of the EIP register to the stack and then jump to the function. When the function finishes executing, there's this return instruction. Return is just another way of jumping. It's just that return, what it does is it pops the value of the return value from the stack and jumps there. So a call and return is just another way of doing a jump with additional housekeeping happening behind the scenes. So when the return executes, return looks here in the stack, and that's where it locates the address where it needs to jump to continue executing the program. Any questions about that? We'll see this in action shortly. Well, let's do a little exercise to get things going. I'd like you to look at the same bot as before. We're looking at SDBot. And I would like you to locate two functions in the given address range. And for each of these functions, I would like you to identify the parameters, the arguments that are passed into those functions. I'd like you to also identify the local variables that they use. I would like you to be able to locate the prologue and the epilogue of those functions. So take a look at these functions. I want to make sure you understand the anatomy, the key structure of these functions. Take a look, and in a few minutes, we're going to go over the solution. All right, let's take a look at these examples. So here's the first function that I wanted you to take a look at. Subroutine 405572. So a few things I wanted to show you here, both how to read the prologue and the epilogue, but also how to get used to the way IDA Pro represents information to you. So where does the function begin? Well, you can see that it starts at 405572, and its first instruction is push EBP. One thing to get used to is the way IDA Pro is able to insert additional information into this block of code. Notice that it defines several labels. So it says that if anywhere within this function you see buff, what that really means is negative 200H. If you see S, that means 8, and if you see arg4, that means 0C in hexadecimal. This is what IDA Pro inserted here to make it easier for you to read these things. It does not mean that the original assembly code actually has this information. It's just trying to help you out. So initially some people get confused when they think that there are multiple instructions located on the same address. No, that's not the case. There is a single instruction here at the top. That only instruction is push EBP. Everything else above it is just some labels that IDA Pro added there to make it easier for you to read this. So our first instruction here is push EBP. That is common. Most functions will do that. It is saving EBP because in the next instruction, it is overriding it by saving ESP into EBP. And from now on, EBP is not going to be changed. It's going to be our baseline with respect to which we're going to reference parameters and local variables. The next instruction, sub ESP200H. We're subtracting from ESP the value of 200 in hexadecimal. Why are we doing that? This is one of the ways in which functions allocate space on the stack. Why are we subtracting? Well, you might recall that the stack grows towards smaller addresses. So if you wanted to allocate space on the stack and ESP is here, you would want to subtract ESP so to move it upwards towards smaller addresses. So whenever you subtract from the ESP, you're really moving ESP up to leave space for some variables on the stack. So that's the purpose of the sub ESP200H. Then we're saving EDI to the stack, presumably because EDI is going to get modified here. And that's why it's not surprising that close to the end, we are popping EDI before leaving. Yes. What if the subtraction results in ESP being less than zero? That should not be possible because ESP values are sufficiently large. And yes, it grows towards smaller addresses, and theoretically at some point it will reach zero, but that's when Windows will probably start telling you that you're running out of memory, and eventually it'll probably shut down the process. Yeah. So let's see. So we've got our prologue. The epilogue, well, it pops EDI to restore it to the way it was because it was pushed here earlier. And then leave is a shorthand for that common epilogue. Leave executes move EBP into ESP and pop EBP. It's just that here it's implemented using leave. Now, what about the use of local variables versus parameters? Well, let's see. You see, negative 200 is represented as buff. So whenever you have EBP plus buff, this really means EBP minus 200. And as I mentioned earlier, whenever you have EBP minus something, that means it's a local variable. So we've got a single local variable here that IDA Pro is calling buff. And we have it referenced in several locations, like EBP plus buff, EBP plus buff again and again and again. Think of it as a reference to a local variable called buff. That's where it's going to be saving some data. You also have 200, you also have 8 and 0C. These are positive values. And it's S and arg4. And you have a reference to EBP plus arg4. That's a reference to a parameter or an argument because it's EBP plus some value. So we've got EBP plus arg4 and also EBP plus S, two parameters that were passed into this function. So that's what I wanted you to be able to do. We're not getting into the internals of what the function is actually doing. I wanted you to be able to see where does it end, where does it start? What are the parameters that it accepts? What are the local variables that it uses? And in this particular case, this function does not actually return anything. It does not return any value. Some functions do that. Let's look at another example. It's pretty similar. You'll see that these functions, their core elements don't really change. Again, we've got our standard prologue, saving EBP and saving ESP registers. We allocate space on the stack for a local variable by subtracting 200 from ESP. And there's a single local variable that's used here. It's called buff, which is EBP minus 200, H. And we've got three parameters this time. 8, 0C, and 10. IDA Pro calls it S, arg4, and arg8. Any questions about anatomy of a function, these core elements, and the way the stack is used to keep track of variables? All right, good. So we've talked a little bit about the way a compiler might try to optimize code or might choose not to do so. Things can get quite a bit more complicated to understand assembly if the compiler was trying to optimize code. The one example that to me really demonstrated the power and the risk that a compiler can introduce when compiling programs. This goes back to a presentation I heard a couple years ago. And the researchers were looking at OpenSSL. OpenSSL is a common set of libraries to implement SSL communications. I believe it was Tom Liston was one of the researchers. And they were noticing that when you dump memory of a system that is using OpenSSL to implement, let's say, SSH, they noticed that passwords were being kept in memory and were staying in memory even after the program should no longer be using that password. And that's bad programming practice. If you're writing a secure program, once you take a password from the user and you no longer need it, you're supposed to zero it out in memory so that it's no longer recoverable. So that was strange. Seemed like a vulnerability in OpenSSL because it would allow somebody who can look at memory to recover people's passwords. But when they looked at the source code, they noticed that the programmer did the right thing. The programmer does have code that zeroes out the password in memory after it's no longer necessary. So if the programmer zeroes it out, why does it stay there anyway? The answer is compiler optimization. You see, a compiler was looking at this code when compiling it, and it said, so I see you're writing something to memory. You're writing zeros because the programmer was zeroing out the password in memory. The compiler saw that the programmer was writing zeros to memory, but later on he noticed that the program never reads those zeros from memory. And the compiler said, well, you're saving something in memory, but you're not reading it back. I guess you don't really need to save it into memory. And the compiler removed those instructions. And it makes sense from the efficiency standpoint, right? Why bother saving something if you're never going to read it? Well, it turns out that you really wanted to save those zeros to override the password. So the proper thing to do here would have been to designate a block of code as something that a compiler should not try to optimize. But it shows you how compilers can do things in slightly unexpected ways when they try to optimize things. For example, one type of optimization that can really slow you down is when a compiler decides to unroll a loop. Loop unrolling, what's that about? Well, let's say the compiler sees that a programmer is implementing a loop and the loop is going to execute 6 times. So what a compiler decides to do is instead of implementing that loop, it takes that code and it simply pastes it in 6 times. Instead of looping, it just repeats copies of this code over and over again. You say that makes no sense. Well, yes, the resulting program is going to be larger than if this block of code existed in only one place, but it will execute a little bit faster because there's a slight performance overhead to implementing a loop because you need to jump around and you need to check to see if it's time to stop looping. So you might be looking at a block of code and you say, well, all right, I understand what this block of code does. And here it is again, and here it is again, and again and again. You might wonder, why didn't the programmer just create a loop? Well, maybe the programmer created a loop, but a compiler decided to unroll it. And another example of a similar technique is when a compiler decides to put a function in line, and that's something that we talked about earlier. You might also wonder, in some cases, why isn't the program removing a variable from the stack? It's supposed to. A function is supposed to remove a variable from the stack if it no longer needs it. Well, a compiler may have decided that this variable will be used later on and decided not to remove it. So you will see some strange things like that. Also, something else to get used to are these slightly esoteric ways of performing certain operations. For example, if you wanted to set a value of a register to 0, one way to do this would be to say move 0 into that register. But it turns out that there is a more efficient way to do that by saying XOR that register with itself. XOR is a Boolean operation, exclusive OR. And if you XOR a value with itself, it'll always result in 0. And it seems that it is faster to do XOR than a move. So sometimes you will see, actually quite frequently, you will see XOR EAX with EAX. And you might wonder why. It's just a fast way of setting EAX to 0. And Intel has a bunch of specialized instructions like leave, like loop, that allow you to implement several instructions in one step. One of these is exchange. If you wanted to swap values of two registers, you could do that with a single instruction using exchange. Or you could save the value of one register to a temporary location, then take it from that temporary location, put it into another register. You could have done this in, I guess, three instructions. You can do it in one using swap. And Intel has a lot of these. And where things get really tricky is with operations like shift to the right or shift to the left, SHR and SHL. Because there's this mathematical property that if you take a register and if you shift its bits to the right by X, then it's equivalent to dividing the value of that register by 2 to the power of X. And if you shift it the other way, then it's equivalent to doing a similar operation but multiplying things. So you might see a bunch of shift operations and you might wonder why they're shifting bits around. Well, it is because they found an efficient way to multiply or divide by 2 to the power of X. And this is oftentimes done in encryption. So whenever I see a lot of these shift operations, there's a good chance that there's some kind of encryption or decryption taking place. And one more interesting instruction that you might be wondering about is the instruction LEA. LEA stands for load effective address. And it is used in cases where a program is making a reference to an indirect memory address. And that is to say, when a program computes a memory address during runtime, using syntax like EAX plus EBX plus 2. Sometimes a program may decide to compute that memory address and store it in a register. And that's what it uses LEA for. So LEA does not save the data where this is pointing. LEA would actually perform this computation and save the memory address into the register. But the thing about LEA is that it does not care whether it operates on real memory addresses or not. So sometimes compilers decide to use LEA to perform mathematical calculations. So if you wanted to add EAX with EBX with 2, you could have done that in three different instructions. Or you can do that in one step using LEA. Even though these values might not be referring to actual memory addresses. This is a little bit confusing sometimes. Because you see something like this and you might wonder, but hold on, EAX is 1 and EBX is 2. That cannot possibly be a memory address. Doesn't matter, because the result, if this is 1 and this is 2 and this is 2, will be 5. So at the end of this, ECX will contain the value of 5 in my example. So LEA is sometimes used, like what I'm showing you on the slide, to do some basic arithmetic calculations in one step. And if you're really interested about some of the more esoteric ways of using assembly instructions to perform calculations, there's a reference to a paper where I think people are doing really some creative stuff. I'm not going to get into it. So that's as much as I want to say in the context of assembly primer, right? These are the core concepts that I think you need to know to be able to read assembly when reverse engineering malware. Of course, there's more to learn, and the more assembly you know, the easier it will be for you to do this kind of work. But these are really the core concepts. And now I want to start showing you some examples. And examples in the context of malware. And I'm going to start off by talking about some of the anti-disassembling techniques that malware authors might use against us. We're going to actually build upon this tomorrow as well. To remind you of something I mentioned earlier today, the job of a disassembler is really challenging. The biggest challenge that it needs to overcome is in determining what is code and what is data. What should it disassemble and treat as instructions, or what is meant to be just data that the program operates on? And mature, advanced disassemblers like IDAPRO and OliDebug really use a hybrid approach, different techniques and heuristics to determine what is code, what is data. One approach is to perform a linear sweep. It basically looks to see how a given segment is labeled, and if it's labeled code, it's going to say, well, I guess everything here is code. And if it's labeled data, it's going to say, I guess everything there is data. That's a bit too simplistic, right? Because you might have code intermingled with data. So there's another way to do this. It's called recursive traversal. And what a disassembler will do in this case is it will actually look at every single jump and at every single call, and it'll try to create a call tree to see through which code could the program possibly traverse when it executes. And everything that it has traversed through, it'll say, oh, that's code. And everything that it did not touch, it'll say, I guess that must be data. This is going to have some limitations as well. And most disassemblers combine these two techniques and use various other heuristics. But sometimes they get it wrong. I want to show you those examples here. Attackers know that sometimes our tools can get it wrong, so they do some interesting things. One of the ways in which they can confuse us and our disassemblers is to insert a lot of junk code, code that does not matter. Here's an example. Let's say you're disassembling this program, and you say, okay, here's one instruction. It's an instruction, push A. Push A is an instruction to save the state of all registers onto the stack in a single step. Okay, not a big deal. Then you've got a bit of data here, and then you've got more instructions. And there are a lot of these instructions here, so if you are analyzing this, you would spend a lot of time trying to figure out what these instructions do. But what eventually you might realize is that none of these instructions matter. Because what the program does later on is an instruction called pop A that restores the registers the way they were. So what happens here is you've got a program that saves the registers, and then there's a whole lot of code that manipulates the registers, and it adds them, and it subtracts them, and it moves them around and shifts them back and forth. And you try to follow it, and it's really confusing. And guess what? None of it matters. Because then there's an instruction like pop A that disregards all of these calculations. And then you have a single instruction that matters, this move instruction. And then another push A and more junk code. So you have a whole lot of instructions, and most of them don't matter. And it can be really hard to focus on those instructions that are actually meaningful. It can slow you down. But things like this happen, and the easiest way to identify it is if you keep seeing these push A, pop A operations, then there's a good chance then the code between push A and pop A might be junk code. So you're wondering, how does code like this find its way into the compiled executables? Well, it is certainly possible for the malware author to insert this explicitly into his code, but in most cases, it is the job of a packer to do this. So, because most malware is not written by people who are experts at writing programs that are difficult to analyze. They end up outsourcing that functionality to packers. But a packer is written by a guy who knows how to confuse us, so he'll take the original program and encrypt it, and his unpacking code will contain lots of this junk stuff. So that if you try to figure out the unpacking algorithm, you're gonna get stuck. Here's another example of where your tools and an analyst can get really confused. I think it's really cool. On the top of this slide is a block of code as seen through OliDebug. Let's take a look at it. The code is at the label shellcode, and there's a call to a single function. And the function actually, this is using a relative addressing, and the function is wherever shellcode is pointing, plus 4. And shellcode is a label that points to 417,000, so you add 4 to it, and you end up with 417,004, and this is the function that it's going to call. But you know where this function is located? It's in the middle of this instruction. Now, this call is represented using E8FFFFFFF. So when it calls, the next instruction that it's going to execute is going to be FFC3. So when you look at it, you say, well, it's a call to some function, and then there's a return. But when you actually execute it, when it implements the call, it's going to readjust itself, and the next instruction that it's going to execute is going to be FFC3, which is actually increment EBX. So what you don't realize is that this code increments EBX. You look at it, you'd never see it, because a disassembler couldn't quite figure out which instructions are going to be executed. And this is perfectly legal. You can have an instruction jumping into the middle of itself. Very, very tricky. Now, the good news is that if you actually step through this program using a debugger like OliDebug will readjust itself. But if you look at it statically, it's really hard to notice these sort of things. So keep an eye out for calls to a function that actually reside in the middle of an instruction. Here's another interesting example. This is a tricky jump. So let me take you through this particular example. This is on page 120 if you're following in the book. So I mentioned to you that the instruction return is just a jump. How does return know where to jump? Well, it looks at whatever value is on top of the stack. It grabs it from the stack, and this is where it jumps. So take a look at how malware might use it. We see a call to a function 401006. Where is that function? Well, 401006 is actually the next line, which is a little bit weird. Why would you want to call a function on the next line? Even if this is a NOAP, the CPU will simply execute the next instruction anyway. Ah, it's because a call doesn't just simply jump there. A call does one more thing. A call before jumping saves the state of the EIP register to the stack. So after this call, the next instruction that's going to be executed will be pop EBX, but that will actually happen after, behind the scenes, the processor will push EIP onto the stack. So the next instruction is pop EBX. This will grab the value from the top of the stack and save it into the EBX register. So now, EBX contains the value that used to be in the EIP register. Then we add 6 to EBX. Then we push the result onto the stack, and then we have return. What does return do? It jumps. Where does it jump? It jumps to whatever value happens to be on the top of the stack. And that's the value that we just calculated and placed there. And that value, if you perform these calculations, the value that's now on the top of the stack is 401000C, which is actually this line over here. And you say, well, how is that possible? How can it possibly jump in here? Isn't this an ASCII string hide? Well, it is and it isn't. It is data if you treat it as data, but if you treat this value, which is 68, 69, 64, 65, and 0, 0, if you treat it as an instruction, that is actually an instruction push 65, 64, 69. So what you don't realize is happening here is that this code actually executes this push because of this tricky jump into this instruction. When all the debugs saw this initially, it did not notice that this is going to be a jump, so therefore it treated this as data. But as you step through this, you will notice that it jumps here, and all the debug will readjust itself. But when you look at it statically, it's very easy to get confused. So how would you discover this? Well, it's really hard to notice it. You end up having to step through the program and notice these kinds of things. And the way you might notice it is, if you see a call to an instruction that's like right next to it, that's a little bit weird, and that's when you start trying to figure out what is it doing here. So the best way to analyze this is to step through it, do it through dynamic analysis of the code. So was this a result of some twisted compiler? I think this is, again, one of those complications that a packer might install to try to confuse our tools. Yeah. So you might see a code like this. Remember that once an unpacker finishes unpacking, it's going to jump to where it extracted the code. Well, an unpacker might make it difficult for us to follow its jumps so that we don't quite understand how the flow of unpacking works. So it might perform these tricky calculations to calculate dynamically where to jump next. And we're going to have a hard time following unless we really step through all of these instructions. An example that I'm going to show you next week, so I'm not going to dwell on it now, is where malware tries to modify PE headers to crash our tools. I'm not going to talk about it just now. Another example that I wanted to show you of how malware might be trying to confuse us deals with exception handling. But what I'm going to do now is introduce to you the concept of exception handling. And we're going to revisit this concept tomorrow, and I'm going to show you how malware authors abuse this concept. And it is abused all the time to really trick us. But to prepare you for that tomorrow's discussion, I want to explain to you what structured exception handling is. The idea behind structured exception handling is relatively straightforward. It's a way for programmers to be able to handle unexpected problems. And structured exception handling is common enough and is difficult enough to pronounce that people just call it SEH, structured exception handling. As a programmer, you want to write code that is resilient, but it's also hard to anticipate every single problem that your program might encounter. For example, maybe you're writing a program to write files to disk, and things can go wrong. Who knows? And maybe your disk is going to crash, maybe a file system is going to fill up, maybe you're not going to be granted privileges to write to the file. So one way in which you can write this code is to say, I would like you to please execute these instructions. But if something goes wrong, please call this exception handler to take care of the problem or to recover from the error gracefully so that the program doesn't just crash. So as a programmer, if you use SCH, you would write your code and you would enclose it within special tags. The tags are in C++, try and accept. You will say execute this code block, and if something goes wrong, execute the following function to recover from the problem. That function that's going to recover the problem, or the function that's going to recover gracefully, is called the exception handler. It's called structured exception handling because the way the assembly code keeps track of all this exception handling information is using the stack. And the information on the stack is structured in a very well-defined way. That's why it's called structured exception handling. I'm going to show you how it's used here in an example of an exploit. And we're going to revisit this topic in an even more important concept of malware trying to use SCH to confuse us. So, let's understand how SCH works. Let's say a program running on Microsoft Windows crashes. How does Microsoft Windows know how, if at all, it can gracefully handle the problem without just giving you a nasty error message or blue screening? Well, Microsoft Windows, if a problem occurs, will look at a special place in memory that's predefined, and it's going to say, this is where I'm going to try to locate those functions that the program defined as its exception handlers. These functions are linked together in a linked list. Each element in a list contains two values. One of the values is the address of the function that's going to act as the exception handler, and the other element is a pointer to the next exception handling record. That's because a lot of errors are cascading. If one block of code fails, then the block of code that relies on that one is going to fail, and the other block of code is going to fail as well. That's why it's convenient for Microsoft Windows to represent this information in a linked list. So it's going to traverse this linked list looking for those exception handlers that want to take care of the problem. Another thing to keep in mind about the way SCH works on Windows is that when an exception does occur, when a problem happens, and once Microsoft Windows has located the exception handler, it's going to call that function with several parameters. The parameters passed to the exception handler are meant to allow programmer to debug the problem in the future. So among those parameters, you're going to see values of certain registers, for example, so that the developer can record that information and try to understand why did the crash occur. I don't know, sometimes Windows will present to you information and it's going to dump onto your screen a bunch of information about the state of the registers. Well, the way it knows how to do that is because that state of the registers is passed as one of the parameters. Also, one of those parameters that is passed to the SCH handler is the address of the record that was used to locate this exception handler. And that one fact is what allows a lot of exploits to use this mechanism to execute arbitrary code on vulnerable systems.